welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, everyone. This is episode 194. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, coming to you this week from sunny Orlando, Florida, where I just arrived minutes before we started recording. And a little bit of advice for all you travelers, when you're driving near Orlando, carry plenty of cash in the car. All right, with me this week, the usual suspects, James Jones.
Hey.
John Lindemann.
The pleasure is all yours.
Oh, God.
He's trying to make it
catch. Do you script these in ahead of time, John? Do you have like a checklist somewhere? What am I down to? Ah, that's it.
Of course, Greg Lay.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And Greg has formed a coalition government with our guest today, Carl Castaneda.
Yeah, let me just say, I was saying ahoy, ahoy on this show before Greg had even been considered to be a guest.
For Greg to have been conceived.
Exactly. It's, you know, because, you got Burns as well. Obviously, he's really old. And then you got Alexander Graham Bell before that. So you can't beat Alexander Graham Bell.
Put that on a t-shirt.
Unless you're Antonio Meucci and you subscribe to that version of how the telephone got invented, I suppose.
Wow, that is obscure and unneeded.
Wow.
All seven of our listeners right now are Googling who that is.
Yeah.
You're kidding, I am.
So we have an exciting show for you today that was primarily composed by Greg Lay. I've been traveling a lot. But as usual, we're going to kick off a new business. And as our guest, Carl, you're up first with a game that I assume you are playing for Reset Button, your feature on the site. So
no.
Can we look forward to an upcoming audio interview with Michael Jackson?
Oh, man, I wish. Like, I'm sure he'd have tons of interesting things to say.
Yes, in more ways than one.
We got to get a seance going.
Oh, the seance! You know about that?
The whole world knows about.
The worst thing that Britain has ever produced, and we produce the Spice
Besides
Girls.
Besides imperialism, you mean?
Well,
oh, come on.
This is the podcast of obscure historical references already.
Yeah.
This is crazy.
No. I'm not doing this game for a Reset Button, but this game is Sonic 3, which is a great, great game. And I picked it up because I actually turned on... I talked about this for a little bit on the newscast, but I turned on my Wii for the first time in a long time.
Oh, no!
And I saw that I had accumulated something like 3,500 Wii points.
Wait, pause. Accumulated?
Yeah, I know. It's an interesting
Yeah, it's not like they gather interest.
Yeah, where they get lost and show up at your Wii?
No,
Was it like the last day you gave a shit about writing for the site, and it was like, well,
I'm gonna drop $40.
I'll put loads of points on there, because I'm sure it'll get used for Virtual Console Mondays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
yeah,
the next day, it was like, oh, that's right, now.
I thought it was more like the Wii points came to him because they knew they wouldn't be used there, and they're like, this is
the same
asylum. We'll survive here forever.
Yeah, no. I mean, so I saw that I had 3,500, so I just started buying shit, and I bought a few stinkers. Art Style Cubello being the most heinous offender.
Did you buy any games?
It's not that bad.
Did you buy any games?
Says
with
you.
Giant sprites.
He's talking about China Warrior. Did you buy it?
No, Giant Sprite is actually pretty much a check for any game's quality.
Well, no, I thought about picking up some Broken Pixel game just for the hell of it, but I decided
what about
not.
JJ and Jeff, just, you know, for the irony value.
I swear to God, I saw JJ and Jeff on there, and it immediately made me think of that time we talked about it on RFN, and I was just like, oh, maybe I should pick it up. That'll be an interesting story. Hell, I thought about doing a Reset Button on JJ and Jeff.
Oh, no.
Let's not say we did.
As the features editor, I have to draw a line somewhere.
But no, what I bought...
You won't. I'll see that.
God damn it. All right, so I ended up buying, like I said, Cubello. I got a couple Phoenix Wright games because I wanted to play them. Yeah. And I didn't feel like going out to an actual brick-and-mortar store to buy them, so I was like, fuck it, I'm lazy. Then I picked up Sonic 3 because my Genesis had, like, died years ago. And so I haven't played any Sonic games in a long time, aside from, like, Sonic Rush on the DS. And, I mean, I think it's pretty well known that Sonic 3 is the best Sonic.
A lot of people say Sonic 3 and Knuckles, or even Sonic and Knuckles. And I know some people think Sonic 2 is the best, but
no.
I agree with you, Carl.
So people widely know that, except for everyone Johnny knows.
Right.
Exactly.
I think Sonic 3 is the best.
Sonic and Knuckles and... No, wait, is it Sonic 3 and Knuckles? Yeah, that's
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Right. That's, yeah.
Which, by the the way, I played Sonic 3 and Knuckles and Sonic 3 and Sonic and Knuckles for the first time on the PC for the Sonic PC Anniversary Edition, Y2K compliant. It said so on the cover.
Wow.
I'm sure that was a wonderful port executed with masterful care.
Sega finally does something right.
No, yeah, yeah. No, they didn't.
Well, they did. Apparently, they didn't do it right, because when I upgraded my PC to Windows XP, it didn't play anymore because it wasn't compatible.
I stand
nice
corrected.
Job.
So there you go.
You should go back to the year 2000 and it'll work.
Yep.
That OS exactly. That OS came out in what, 2001, and they put this out in 2000 and it wasn't compliant.
But anyway, so yeah, so I had played Sonic 3 a while back, but it wasn't with an actual gamepad; it was with a keyboard. So obviously, this version is way way better. And so, yeah. It's great. I mean, I don't really care for the amusement park stage. I just think, you know, it's there are a lot of cheap deaths there. And there's a certain part right before the last boss in that level where you have to realize that you have to hold down the D-pad and then push it up really quickly to get yourself up on the elevator. And yeah. I couldn't remember that for the life of me. And, I died so many times.
That's very well-known, very famous elevator there. Everybody gets stuck there.
Yeah, so, I it took me, why the hell can't I get up this fucking elevator? I had to go to fucking GameFAQs for it. And
GameFAQs for Sonic just seems wrong.
Yeah, and so, but eventually I got through it or whatever. And, I mean, yeah, it's the best Sonic game. There are almost no bottomless pits, which is the worst part about Sonic as a whole.
Still plenty of spikes, though.
It's a lot of spikes, yeah, and a lot of spikes that rise from the ground that you can hit while you're in a really fast run. But yeah, all in all, though, it's still really, really good, mostly because it introduces the power-ups, the water bubble, the fireball, mm-hmm. and the electricity mm-hmm. shield, and those are the best part of the game.
Yeah.
It just introduces a lot of really cool gameplay elements. I mean, the water, especially, because, especially on the underwater level, where you all of a sudden no longer have to actually look around for balloons and air bubbles, which makes things a whole lot easier. And then, the electricity shield, it attracts rings to you. Yeah, it's great. But, hey, I'm talking about a game that's, 15 years old. So there is another game that I'm playing, but it is for Reset Button, and we're going to save pimping that for the end of the show. But it is awesome.
Stay tuned.
And you will like it. So stay tuned. Don't turn that dial, because it's coming up on the other side.
Yeah, a long other side, far away.
And Carl, you may be aware of this, but there's a really cool thing on Virtual Console where I don't know if you have any interest in Sonic and Knuckles, but if you do download that for Virtual Console, it will mm-hmm. it will actually interact with Sonic 3 and you can play it with the lock-on.
Oh, really?
Which is something I honestly never thought they would actually do on Virtual Console.
That's weird.
It is supported, so you might want to check that out if you have any interest in doing
that. Is that only if you have Sonic 3, though?
Well, right, yeah, you have to have both. I mean,
Just as if you had the two cartridges, yeah. I think the Sonic 2 stuff works, too, as well.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
But Sonic 2, it's more of a cosmetic thing. Yeah. In Sonic 3, you have all of Knuckles' abilities, and there are certain parts of levels that, only he can get to and stuff like that.
Right.
I think, and I want to say even in maybe the first Sonic,
there was a bonus game or something. Although I think it also worked with pretty much any other Mega Drive game. It's pretty much the same thing.
Was.
So it was Sonic 1 or most Mega Drive games would get you that little screen.
Nicely done.
Okay, so James, you're playing a long-awaited or long-anticipated game, and I'm very curious to hear what you have to say about this one.
So I've got, we've gone through the list of games I had to get through before on the show. So I finally got to the end, which would be Fragile Dreams.
After this, James is just going to die. He's just going to fade away. Mm-hmm. There's nothing left for him anymore.
This
is
probably
going
right
to walk
here.
Off into the sunset.
There is going to be a question of what comes after this, but I haven't quite settled it yet. So Fragile Dreams, I'm pretty sure everybody who listens to the show is probably familiar with it, but I'll give the rundown anyway. It's a Namco Bandai game, published by Xseed in the US. Came out, I guess it was about 2 years ago now in Japan.
It was at least a year and plus
change.
A few months.
Yeah. So the premise of the game is that you play as this boy, Seto, who lives in a world where essentially all of humanity's been wiped out.
Except for Seto.
except for Seto and possibly other people. That's what he's operating under in terms of a theory that there's more people out there like him.
Gotcha.
Now, is Seto portrayed by Charlton Heston or Will Smith?
No. Oh, yeah. Chuck Heston just shoots the hell out of people in that movie. I was like,
Yeah, he's kind of a violent.
I haven't seen the Omega Man,
A lot of things are starting to make sense here.
He lived with another survivor who was an old man for most of his life until that old man passed away of natural causes. So now he's on a quest to go to what they describe as, quote, the Big Red Tower east of here, which, if you're familiar with Japanese architecture, you recognize as Tokyo Tower.
Hmm.
In his hope to find more survivors there. I guess because it's so big and bright that it would be a beacon for other people. And basically he has to wander through this world that's now inhabited by the spirits of the deceased, who are mostly out to harm him in his quest to get there. And on his way, as was mostly portrayed in the game, he comes across another survivor, a girl close to his age who basically runs away from him, and he spends the rest of the game trying to catch up to. Now, where the game kind of got its buzz is that A, it's really, really pretty, and B, it's really, really creepy. It's kind of an interesting thing on the system. So, to boil it down to its core, what it really is it's a survival horror game. I mean, it's your standard survival horror game. Kind of think the first few Resident Evils and Dino Crisis and the other games that Capcom built off that engine.
Silent Hill?
Yeah, I guess Silent Hill probably is the best comparison, because you spend a lot of the game wandering through places that are really unnerving for no particular reason other than they just seem off, and then interspersed very, very, almost briefly with scenes of danger, of attacks.
Hmm.
And where the game works at being really creepy is, this is something that I think a lot of survival horror games don't do right. They put you in a woods or in a house. This game, at least for the first two-thirds of the game, after that it kind of falls off this pattern, is the game puts you in places where you expect to encounter people, like a shopping mall, a train station, a theme park, but then takes away everybody. So it's just you in this empty, dark place. So
this really is like I Am Legend or the Omega Man. I mean, it sounds...
Yeah.
It sounds like a very similar premise. Like, it's creepy because he's in these populated areas where there's no population.
Exactly. That's why the game is creepy. These places where you expect there to be bright, lots of light, lots of sound, and lots of people. There's no light, no sound, and no people. So the only light you have is the flashlight that you carry around with you, which I must say, the game does an amazing job with lighting effects for a Wii game. But when you hear sound, it's almost always danger. Because how the game tells you something's getting ready to attack you is it starts to play a sound specific for whatever that enemy is through the Wii remote, which, although the speaker on the Wii remote is not good, it for whatever reason, it coming through the Wii remote makes it way creepier.
Than
it just coming through the TV speakers.
Well, do you remember in Resident Evil 4 Wii Edition, I think it was the Regenerators, the same thing happened where you hear that, like, that white noise, it would come through on the Wii remote, and that was equally creepy.
And they do that in Shattered Memories as well.
That's what it's like, yeah. So one of the places where it's really, really creepy is there's one particular enemy. And I remember this part of the game freaked me out more than any. You're in this really long hallway underground. It's basically connecting an underground mall, which I guess are kind of common in Japan, to a train station, which you take that pathway to get to the shopping arcade. But it's really long. There's no lights inside because there's no electricity. So all the light is your flashlight. And the whole time you're walking down this hall, you're hearing this really maniacal, evil laugh through the Wii remote. And the game's already taught you that laugh is an enemy that's particularly pain in the ass to fight.
Huh.
But unusually, you'd hear the noise, and then, you know, 5-6 steps later, when your flashlight hits an enemy, they become visible. And usually, you're within 15 steps of them being visible. This time, the game just kept that noise playing, and you didn't see them. And every step got more and more terrifying. And writing starts to show up on the wall as you pass it, with phrases like, in Japanese, but if you mouse over them, you can translate, phrases like, something's watching me, and you're going to die, which makes it really unnerving. And then when the thing finally jumps out, it actually comes up, like, right in front of you. It's very few Resident Evil-style scares in the game, because it actually likes to play with your head more than it does
that actually
just...
sounds a bit like Dead Space as well. Dead Space does that too, where you're just walking around these empty areas, and you walk into like a small room, and there's something written on the wall.
And what's really unnerving about the game is that all the really scary writing tends to pop up only when you put your flashlight on it.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll see, like, all these drawings by survivors who are now all gone. Like these little kid drawings on the wall, like they'll be playing tic-tac-toe, or there'll be like a drawing of a girl. And then when you put your flashlight over it, you'll see in what is clearly a child's handwriting, because it's all in hiragana, and I can kind of recognize it's sloppy, the phrase like, I don't want to die, right next to this drawing of this little girl. It's like, oh.
Yeah, creepy.
It sounds really atmospheric. I mean,
it is.
Much more than my expectation of the game.
See, that's where the game succeeds, is it, for the first two-thirds, it creates an amazing atmosphere, and it sort of falls apart later in the game. But what what the game does is Cassetto is just, you know, he's just a kid who's stuck in this world by himself now. He's not a fighter, which means fights are more tense than they really need to be. So you can pick weapons. Basically, there's a ranged weapon, there's a long staff, and then there's kind of sword classes of weapons. You know, the fights are kind of ho-hum, kind of back to the Resident Evil turn like a tank thing where you use the pointer to push to one side or the other to make him turn.
Mm-hmm.
So the controls are kind of dodgy in that respect. I know what they were going for there, but I'd rather just be able to fight. But I guess that would take away some of the real scare of these fights. But the game's caught some... I'm not going to go into too much detail about this, but the game caught some flack for like I said, losing some of its atmosphere towards the end, which I guess I understand story-wise why they did it, but it didn't bother me as much as it's bothered some people.
So, James, what you're saying is that eventually Fragile cracks?
Yeah.
Is that even a joke? Does that even qualify as a joke? I mean,
I'm not even going to say, was that John? I wouldn't demean John like that.
I've been waiting like 15 minutes to make that joke.
Beautiful. Wonderful. Thank you. just a few more points, I guess. I know the game was, for a little while, was being referred to as an RPG, and I can understand why after I've played it, where Seto does level up, gain more health, become stronger, and there's weapon stuff. And it's almost like a, I don't know, dare I say this, but like a mystery dungeon game in the respects that weapons break.
Oh, yeah.
And you have to acquire more of them. But the game literally throws so much money at you, it's almost irrelevant.
Wait. Why would you need money in a world with no people?
Because there is a merchant, but he technically isn't people either, so it's fine.
Is he like a ghost?
Kinda.
What are you buying?
Oh, God.
Maybe Satan, like in Castlevania 64.
Yeah, there you go. Mm. I would say that the merchant in Fragile is creepier than the merchant in Resident Evil 4, but for completely different reasons.
Really?
There.
I think Elmo's creepier than the thing in Resident Evil 4.
Yes. There are other characters in the game, but they're not people. One of the first characters you encounter besides the girl is Seto finds this computer, this talking computer that it's supposed to aid in survival. Basically, it's just a clever way of doing the tutorial. Because she basically just tells you, you should probably be careful here. This floor is cracked. You don't want to run over it. But they kind of couch it in concern for his well-being. So, I mean, this game can be kind of hard to play in extended sessions because it can get really just unnerving to play it for a while, and the game itself is kind of sad. I mean, it's a pretty heavy game to play, so unlike my normal, I'm going to play this game for 6 hours straight, and that's going to be it for the day. It's like, I'm going to play this game for an hour, and now I can't play anymore. I have to step away for a little bit.
So this is another in a long line of Xseed commercial failures or seeming commercial failures. Maybe they're happy with the sales. I wouldn't be. It's been out for over a month.
Yeah.
Pretty much the first person I've heard say anything about it.
That's kind of sad.
Not a good sign considering how many damn podcasts I listen to. So I don't know how hard or easy it is to go out and find a copy now, but are you recommending it to our listeners and – you know, under what conditions?
It's pretty easy to find a copy. It's still $50. It's not real long. I'm not sure how much replayability there is. I think I beat it in like 13, 14 hours.
That didn't stop you from recommending fucking that plane game.
I felt that game had replayability to it, where I don't feel like this game has nearly as much.
Hmm.
Because, I mean, in this game, you've seen all its creepiness. You know the plot story. It's not going to get you again a lot of the same ways.
That's what's carrying you through the experience.
Yeah, it's... Mm-hmm.
How much is the gameplay... Does it ever feel like a chore? Do you ever feel like you could use with it being streamlined? Or does it fit in with the ambiance?
Yes, that's actually a good point, because there is... There are a couple fetch quests in the game that they basically say, hey, remember when you were in that really creepy place like 5 hours ago? Here's a shortcut to go back there. Go back there and get something and then bring it back here. Now, they don't make you go retrace all your steps all the way back. And usually they show you something new on the other side when you go back that way. But there's just something about having to go back through these places that you hacked your way through the first time. You're like, I don't want to go back there. It's like that place wasn't... I was happy to be rid of that place before. I don't want to go back.
Some padding, a little.
A little bit. Like I said, they do build a new route to get to those places.
Yeah, it's not entirely duplication. But
only one of them makes you go back any significant distance.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I just think, you know, one of the things played, having played a few of these games that are heavy on atmosphere, is just there's nothing that's going to take you out of it quicker than onerous gameplay requirements, whether
right.
it would be in combat or stuff like fetch quests. So where would you put it?
What happened is, as I got more aware of the game's methods of, you know, really getting to you, the game itself became less creepy.
Sure.
And it lost some of its atmosphere in that respect. But the fetch quest was one of the places it sends you back to, is that underground mall, which lost some of its creepiness because, A, the enemies there aren't particularly strong now because you've become...
Yeah, because of the RPG stuff. Right,
right. So they're almost not really an issue anymore. And to be honest, you can run straight through most enemies in true survival horror fashion. You can just cut around them. So that's probably the only way that it really takes you out of the game. I mean, the combat itself isn't very good, but it's there's so little of it, to be honest.
Right.
I mean, you might go 3 or 4 minutes without encountering an enemy. And so when you do, you're more concerned about, oh shit, there's something here, versus the, why am I doing is hitting A while he swings his tatami sword.
So you're saying you are recommending it?
I would recommend it to people who are okay with it being, you know, a 15-hour, mostly ambiance-driven game. People who like survival horror games will probably enjoy it. I might say wait a little bit longer, because it quite possibly could see a price drop. I would imagine it's probably due for one. Like, I'm not upset that I paid $50 for it, but I have a good disposable income. So if you don't have a big gaming budget and can't really afford to spend a lot of money on gaming, I would hold off a little bit.
Okay, cool. John is up next, and I know you've barely played your game, but you're still going to make me really jealous. So what can you tell us about 3D.GameHeroes?
If you like Zelda games, you're going to like 3D.GameHeroes.
I do. Do you like Zelda games?
I do.
Do you play Zelda games, John?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do, James. Haven't you said enough, James? Jesus.
God. That rage has been bubbling for years, and now it's just all coming out.
Not in front of the guests.
3D.GameHeroes. Yeah, it has that whole kind of like Link to the Past thing. Just they've just completely nailed it. You know, music-wise, the music is actually almost 8-bit.
Oh, very much so. I got this as well. I managed to play through the first dungeon.
Oh, so you've played more than John has.
Well, maybe. I'm not going to...
Most likely, yeah. Yeah, the only thing I've done so far is I've actually just grabbed the sword that you get at the beginning of the game, just like every single Zelda game, so...
Wow.
Well, you see, that's the thing. See, this is more years of old school, because you don't have to do three things before you get the sword.
Mm-hmm.
The music seems pretty cool. It's got some 8-bit instruments in it, and especially the first boss fight. It's got some pretty badass 8-bit boss music going on.
Yeah. Now, Greg, how do you feel about the kind of the blurring effect they have going on? Because
the depth stuff. Yeah,
it's kind of weird.
Got this depth of field stuff. It adds to it. It makes it trippier, I think.
Yeah.
You know, it's distinctive. You know, when you see things with the sort of really sharp clarity, then they kind of have this different quality, almost like a sort of papercraft quality to them.
Mm-hmm.
Even though obviously it's going for a kind of 3D pixel, that's the whole aesthetic. But yeah, I almost wish like they eased off it a little bit and expanded the field of view,
mm-hmm.
so that more of it was in focus.
Mm-hmm.
From the default camera angle anyway. I mean, you can sort of elevate it and look at it from a more overhead.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks you right in. I mean, it's really, really good, definitely. If you liked like A Link to the Past, it's pretty much that turned into blockiness. Block has the block filter
the
applied to all the characters, and you can actually create your own character as well at the start. And what's kind of different is you can choose from, I think, probably about 12 different characters, like pre-created characters.
Yeah, there's a lot of them, actually. There's more than I thought.
Now, I don't know if you've tried more than one, Greg.
No, I've only tried the default guy.
Yeah.
I haven't. I hope to use subsequent ones. I want, this is really obscure, but I want the 8-bit sprite from Demon Returns in the second Game Center CX game. If someone out there wants to make that, then I'll use it.
Well, you can upload your creations online, I think.
Oh, of course, yeah. And then you just put it in the USB drive or something, and then it'll, you can read it off that to put it in your game. But like, I strongly doubt I'll ever get around to creating anything.
Well, my copy is waiting for me when I get back to Texas.
Yeah, you're going to love it.
Dude, I cannot wait. So probably more on that next week or the week after. Yes. And Greg, actually, you are up next.
Yeah, so other than continuing to indulge my appetite for Zelda clones of various sorts, not long done with the Ocarina of Time aping Darksiders. But what I've mostly been playing up until today was Assassin's Creed 2, which is terribly old hat at this point, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. I've been enjoying it. It's not really my kind of game, generally, because it's very, you know, story-driven, and there's a lot of kind of the open world sort of stuff and all that. I generally prefer things to be more structured and skill-based and all that, but looking at the tombs, for instance, where you've got those sort of platforming parts, the platforming heavy parts.
Did you like those parts?
I did like them.
My favorite part of that
game. It's the best part of the game. Yeah, easily.
I like them. I think what's really interesting about it is almost a new kind of platforming, at least to me, from the point of view that it's not about tremendous timing or reflexes or skill in the traditional sense. It's about observation.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's it is just simply interpreting the environment in front of you that's trying to be as organic as possible into an obstacle course, and it's, you're basically, if you can interpret it correctly, you could do it, because you pretty much just press the appropriate direction on the control stick, and you know, that's about it. But that's the tricky part, is actually piecing it together. And I suppose that is one element that only kind of, you know, we talk about, you know, how much do superior graphics really give you for gameplay and stuff. Well, this sort of game is only really possible in this way with detailed graphics, because of, you know, if they weren't detailed and realistic and organic to the point that they are, it would just be really obvious what everything is, and then it really would feel like, oh, I'm just pressing the right direction,
totally,
and that's all there is. There's nothing to it.
If you weren't able to notice that these blocks of stone look different than these other blocks of stone, then you wouldn't know. I mean, you wouldn't be able to get through the course. Like, you have to really notice the finer details and how things look different.
There has to be the distinction there, but it has to be subtle.
Exactly.
If it's not subtle, if it's blatant, then I think the whole thing would just fall apart and it would feel kind of pointless, a bit of a chore.
Totally.
And of course, that does apply to the world itself as well. You find all these different places that you try, you have certain viewpoints you might want to get to, and things, you know, those do apply as well. But it's an interesting thing. It was similar when I've been playing MotorStorm Pacific Rift, the Sony exclusive racing game, in that a lot of the gameplay in that, arguably, is your ability to kind of pick out the sort of different routes in the heat of the action.
Yeah, they don't spell it out for you.
Yeah, it's so detailed and so organic. Again, it's not like this is a racetrack and here it forks. You know, you've got to interpret that information, which is very, you know, dense, on the fly.
Yeah, and experiment too a little bit.
What you guys are talking about reminds me of a phenomenon in animation where you see a lot of cheap hand-drawn animation, and I'm thinking of stuff like Scooby-Doo.
You can tell what's going to move and what won't.
Yes,
exactly. Yeah, because like the background looks like the background, and if there's a door that's about to fly open, or if there's something that's going to roll over in the animation, it looks brighter because they've basically just reused a lot of things. And you compare that to like a Disney movie, like a really high quality Disney movie, where they use more keyframes and just better inking technology, and just they spend more effort on it, and those movies are a lot more surprising and unpredictable because you can't just look at it and tell what's about to happen. And I think it's like it's really a problem that we shouldn't have, right? If everything was up to a certain level of quality, of visual fidelity, then you really wouldn't have that. But in video games, we're just now getting to the point where, and I love the way Greg put it, because it made me think of like a Mario game. It's kind of like, there's a reason that Mario games look cartoony, but imagine putting Mario in I mean, look, go back to like Mario Sunshine, where he's inside that hotel. Now put Mario inside a real hotel. He wouldn't know what he could jump. Well, he wouldn't know what he could jump on and what he couldn't.
Yeah.
And then you go to something like Mirror's Edge, which is, you know, as we've said before, it's another kind of 3D platformer, and they literally have to highlight things in the environment, because if they don't, it's almost impossible to tell where you can go and where you can't.
Because you will run into shit constantly thinking, oh, I can jump. And even though they do that, it's still kind of hard sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It is, but it's because of control issues. I'm much more impressed by what Ubisoft has done in the Assassin's Creed games and in Prince of Persia as well, where they, instead of like literally highlighting things in the environment, they just use the art style. I mean, it's just very, very, very well done. You can look at the place, and 99% of the time, you can train your eyes. And if you really think about it and say, what would I do next if I was here and if I had this guy's agility? And that will work.
Yeah, and I mean, they'd have certain tells in there that they try and sort of work in the most organic way possible. Like, you know, if you have certain bits of scenery that have the white linen on them, that's like telling you it's a good point to sort of set off on a free run up onto the roofs and things like that. Or like you've got the little bits where you can see birds' nests, and that tells you can leap off into a hiding spot. So the tells are there, but again, they're woven in rather than obviously because of the whole storyline conceit and the animus and stuff, they can draw attention to things with this sort of artifice quite easily, but for a lot of these things they don't, and I feel like that's really kind of the point. That's why I thought it was really unique that this was a situation where the graphical fidelity had made gameplay that I hadn't played before. Which normally when we say that, we think of just things being bigger and better. And certainly, you know, the sheer size of some of the environments, you know, this year, obviously you couldn't do that with a less powerful machine. But in terms of just the detail stuff,
I think this is something Nintendo's going to have to deal with more and more as their technology improves. You know, they've kind of delayed having to deal with this problem. But even on GameCube, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in Metroid Prime where Retro Studios use the art direction to kind of give you cues as to what you could do and what you couldn't, because the fidelity of the graphics is so high that it could very easily make it so that everything looks interactive or consequently nothing looks interactive.
I mean, the scan visor, obviously.
Yeah, and the scanning visor is a way to throw an artificial mask over everything, so now you can see what's interactive.
Right.
But there's a lot of other things they do too, even without that. And it makes me think, you know, I don't think Mario's ever going to go all that realistic, so that's becomes a huge problem for it. But I think for Zelda, it could very well be.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, Mario revels in its abstraction, and that should never change. But, for certain other things, who knows?
Zelda and Metroid, in particular.
Yeah.
All right, well, we're almost done with new business. I don't really have a whole lot to talk about here, because...
Toll booths.
Toll booths.
That game you've been playing.
Yeah.
Alternate reality game.
It's more like Johnny Avoid Road Rage, but I've been traveling so much the past week that all I've really been playing is Picross 3D, which I don't want to talk about again. But I do want to say, last night I had the opportunity to stay in Tallahassee, Florida with our old friend Mike Sklins, the co-founder of this very podcast, Striker Obi. We had a good time. I got to meet his very nice girlfriend, and we stayed up late playing DJ Hero.
Wait, Mike bought DJ Hero?
He probably got it for about $20. That game is so cheap now.
It must have been an
accident. I think he said he got it as a gift.
Oh, okay.
Okay, there you go.
For one thing, it was on PS3, which I doubt that would have been his first choice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
The stupid relative of his didn't understand the difference.
Well, it's one of those games where after you turn it on, you can't even tell what system it's on, because you're using this unique controller anyway, and the graphics aren't that interesting.
They're pretty irrelevant.
Or that different per platform.
Pretty irrelevant.
They are. I mean,
yeah, I'm sure John will vouch for the Wii version, and I'm sure it's fine on every platform. But I had played a little bit of DJ Hero in the store demo, which is never a good setting to play something like that. And so I was very curious. I mean, it was one of these situations where it's like, hey, let me look at all the games you've got and let's pick one out and play it together. And that was the first thing I went to, because I was like, I would like to spend some quality time with DJ Hero. I haven't really done that.
Did he roll his
eyes? We had a really good time with him. we had a good time with DJ Hero. I think we played it for about an hour and just took turns. I mean, he only had one turntable, which is, you know, all I would expect.
Turns at the turntable.
How'd you like the controller?
I think the only problem, well, you know, and we've mentioned before how the crossfader switch needs to probably have more of a groove in the middle or make more of a sound as you go over the center position.
Yeah.
That, I think that's obvious to anybody who's played the game for even once. Maybe one other thing I would say is that I'm okay with the button. You know, it has these three different color buttons that are on the turntable, and I'm okay with that. I think it's an unusual kind of physical challenge to keep your fingers positioned on the buttons while you turn the table.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of have to use your entire hand. It's like you're bracing with your pinky and your thumb on the edge, and it's a weird physical movement, but I feel like that's kind of part of the game.
Yeah.
But the weakest aspect of it to me is just pushing the buttons on the turntable. Maybe it's partially like some kind of lag situation with HDTVs, and maybe it just wasn't synced up super well, but I feel like you don't really get that punch, and part of it's because you're not playing an instrument, you're mixing, and so it doesn't necessarily feel like something discrete happens when you push this button.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to me, there's a disconnect between pushing the button and hearing something in the music to go along with it. But also, I feel like those buttons don't really have a good push to them.
Yeah, they're kind of soft.
Well,
did you find
I don't
that?
Really feel like they give much at all, you know? Like, I just feel like I'm pushing it, and I know it worked because I can see on the screen, mm-hmm. but it doesn't feel like I did it right,
yeah.
You know? It's kind of like typing on a shitty keyboard that doesn't have enough pushback. Like, you can see on the screen that you're typing correctly, but your fingers are telling you, ooh, I don't know, and there's all this doubt about, did I hit that, did I not? It just
Shut
doesn't
up,
feel
fingers.
Right. That's kind of how I feel about it. But I mean, overall, I think it's a cool controller. I'd be very interested to see if they make any revisions to the hardware for the sequel.
I can't
because
believe
I think the gameplay is pretty tight. I mean, I think the game design is nice.
It is,
I like
and
it.
I like the fact that it has that kind of third element of having to navigate the lines for the crossfader. I mean, I would like to see somebody that's really like an expert level player go to town on some of those harder songs because it would be
expert level
it would be crazy. It's like spinning plates and like, you know, trying to, I don't know.
It's like spinning plates and trying to make a simile.
Do something else at the time you're spinning the plates.
It does feel like you are mentally juggling two or three very distinct different things that aren't necessarily related to each
yep.
other. And the interface, the visual interface is not super intuitive. I had to play three or four songs before I really understood what was going on with the lines and how they interact or don't interact with the scratching and all that. I mean, there's just certain things about the visual presentation that it just took me a while to get used to it, I guess, is what I would say. And I played plenty of Guitar Hero and Rock Band, so it's just very different. Very different, but I had a really good time with it, and most of the mixes we picked out I thought sounded pretty good, including one that he was opposed to me choosing, which was Ice Ice Baby and Straight Up by Paula Abdul.
Oh no!
I thought it was actually a really good mix. I thought it was a really good mashup.
Yeah, there's some that you would think would be really, really good, and they're awful, and then some that you would think would be awful and are actually great. It's a real strange mix.
Are there some that you think will be awful and they are awful?
Yeah, less often than you think. Because, you know, it's like usually you like at least one song of the mix, so it's not a complete disaster.
Yeah, they do a nice job of usually pairing up very, very different songs in these mashups.
Yeah.
So it's rarely like two rap songs. It's rarely like two pop songs. You know, it's usually one of each or some other genre. They almost always mix genres. And so, yeah, I think you're right, John. In most of these mashups, you will like at least one of the two songs. I was surprised. I'm kind of very interested to see what they do with the sequel, and it's the kind of thing where if the price ever got down low enough, like clearance low, I would probably pick it up, even though I think I'm terrible at it, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know how much I would really sit down and play it, because it just doesn't feel as tight, it doesn't feel as immediately satisfying as Guitar Hero did the first time I tried that. But I would not mind owning a copy of it. I just, you know, because of all these things I've said, I wouldn't pay that much for it. But
yeah.
I do think it's very well done. I really
do. Yeah, you can get it on sale now for about $50. I've seen it really, really cheap.
Hmm. Okay, anyway, that's new business. Now we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we have all kinds of listener mail. We're going to catch up on that, so stick around. We'll be right back, SNL. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. It's now playing time. It's been a very good week. Lots of great coverage, and Carl's going to help us out.
Okay, well, first up, Pedro's going to be taking an advanced look at Disney's upcoming detective party game, Disney Guilty Party, and you might want to be on the lookout for it. Also, over in the blog section, Neil's going to be dishing out the pain at Nintendo's New York demo of Photo Dojo, and he wins a trip to Seattle during it. Isn't it Redmond, though? Should it really say Seattle?
Well, I'm sure he's flying into Seattle. He's going out there to see Meg Ryan.
All right. Wow. On the blog scene, we have Zach gives us a review, a tongue-in-cheek review, I might add, of the 2-in-1 padded puppet pouch, a.k.a. zipper face. Let's just call it a unique product in which to wrap your Nintendo DS. Just make sure you bring dog food.
That is one of the funniest things I've read on our site in quite a while. You really have to go see that.
All right. And then on the review front, we have James, our resident RPG guru, reviewing Sakura Wars So Long, My Love. It's perfect for James. The whole title is awesome. He reviews this quirky tactical RPG / dating sim. Once again, perfect for James. And he really likes it despite its bizarre nature. Check out the review to find out why he thinks it's so fantastic.
Oh, John is catching up, making up for lost time, because John was off the show the week that James really talked about the meat of that.
Which I thought was going to be my salvation, but then fuck, he comes along and takes it anyway.
I'm sure he talked about the meat of it. Moving right along, hey!
Oh, best of cold, eh? Neil reviews the simple DSiWare party game Globulous Party, saying that it's fun to play with friends, but it is a little repetitive. And Neil has also spearheaded the WiiWare second anniversary feature, where we look back at 2 years of downloadable original games on Wii, with a feature that's going to run over a number of days that's going to highlight the favourite titles of our staff.
So Neil continues his Extra Life feature with Extra Life 3, where he looks at the somewhat overlooked WiiWare title Lost Winds. He goes back to see what his thoughts were on this, quote, forgotten gem. Thank you, Sean.
So that is another week of Now Playing on NWR, my favorite part of the show. Hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to go check out all this great original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. Alright, we are back for listener mail. All of these questions were submitted to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can email us about anything in the world of video games, or even probably a little outside of that. We are very eager to see all of your emails. We do look at all of them, we read all of them, and we pick the best ones that we can on the show. And I believe Greg selected all of these, and I think he is going to guide us through these, whatever that means.
Yes, through the thick
jungle.
Wood of the of this list. We've got a lot to get through. We're trying to catch up.
Greg is our
but
Sherpa.
We always need more. Don't take the catch-up as an excuse not to submit listener mail. We always need it, and we will try and get through it. So, Carl, you are first.
Okie doke. Well, before I get to my emails, I want to let you know that we do have another avenue for questions, and that is, of course, mailbag@NintendoWorldReport.com.
You bastard.
And, you know, I don't want to say that it's better than RFN, but, you know what's up.
Here we go. Stabber in the back.
Look, if you want well-researched answers instead of just the kind of awesome bullshit we feed you, yeah, go that way. But if you want seat-of-the-pants knowledge, right here.
Absolutely. Nice pants, too. We're very well-dressed.
All right, well, getting to the actual question at hand here. Kyle in Bear, Delaware,
Awesome. Awesome.
Oh, that's never going to get old. Hello, RFN. I love the podcast. Well, thank you so much, Kyle. I'm not on it usually, but for this one I am.
He's not talking to you, Carl.
Okay. I feel like we do have this kind of connection, though. Now, he goes on to say, I recently took the plunge and purchased New Super Mario Bros. For the Wii. This was a matter of much debate in my mind. Having the chance to sample the game periodically, it never struck me as a game I wanted to buy and play. This surprised me as the resurgence of the 2D genre is one of my favorite storylines of the Wii. That's pushing the limit of the meaning of the word storyline.
Just read the letter, damn it.
I have to introduce... This is what people are paying for, Johnny. This commentary. Color commentary.
You're not paid for commentary. You're here to read a script.
All right. But having a GameStop gift card, I took the plunge. And after all, I love side-scrolls, and I felt cool towards Mario Galaxy until I bought it. In a nutshell, I still don't like New SMB Wii. I don't know what it is, but I am never excited to play it. It just doesn't have the same charm to me and feels like a chore whenever I pull it out. Oh, man. I traded it to Amazon and put it towards my Galaxy 2 pre-order. Of the four quote-unquote 2D side-scroller games on the Wii, I have played, and in parentheses he says retail release only, I certainly put this well below the other three. I find Muramasa a far better game and a more enjoyable experience, a significant departure from the RFN crew I know. And I also found much more fun in both Super Paper Mario and Wario Land Shake It. So I have two questions to ask the RFN crew. Number one, what is your favorite side-scroller on the Wii? And number two, do you have a game that garners both critical and commercial success that you just don't like no matter how hard you try? Thanks for the great podcast. Again, Kyle from Bear, Delaware.
All right. Thanks for the great letter, Kyle. Favorite side-scroller on the Wii, should we consider any that were not mentioned here? I mean,
yes. Yeah,
I guess
definitely.
He's primarily referring to platformers, so...
Although, I mean, Muramasa's not really a platformer.
Well, there are platforms to jump on for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, so not integral to the game. I mean, I think for me, a couple of worthy things to consider, A Boy in His Blob, Klonoa, which mm-hmm. is 2.5, whatever, is basically a side-scroller. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I've played through to completion those two and the four that Kyle mentions. So I've played a lot of these, and so I would say, you know, it is one of my favourite things about the Wii is we're getting retail games like these. So I certainly agree with him on that point. But in terms of the favourite, I mean, they are quite different. I guess I care for New Super Mario Bros. Wii a little more than he does, because I'd certainly compare to Muramasa, which I enjoyed, certainly, but I just like the sort of more fast-paced action kind of experience of Mario that feels more involved. But I might go with Wario Land as my favourite push. Mm. I'm not sure. I mean, it's tough. I like all of them in different ways. But Wario Land, just... I know it's obviously it looks great and everything, but going back and doing some of the bonus levels that are a lot more complicated than the normal ones and finding some of the treasures and stuff, which doesn't really have a reward, but it's still fun to do them. There's some really clever level design in there.
It's also a really attractive game, too, to be honest.
Oh, yeah. Beautiful. Apart from the 16:9 issue...
Yes.
It's incredibly good looking. I mean, so is Muramasa and Boy in His Blob, but
yeah,
it's right up there.
James, your favorite side-scroller?
I'm actually inclined to agree with Greg. Same reasons, but I don't have the same distaste for New Super Mario Bros. Wii that he does here, Kyle. But, I mean, it's not... I wouldn't put it in the top 10 Wii games for me, personally. I mean, mm-hmm. I enjoy it. I respect it as a game, but... It for me, it just didn't do it for me at like a really high level, especially in a single player experience.
Yeah. It was just too. It was too similar to the DS version, really, for me.
Well, and I didn't even play the DS version. It was too similar to all the previous Mario.
I still thought it was a significant step up from the DS version, but that doesn't mean that it's all that different at the same time.
Yeah,
it's just kind of
it's definitely
more
better.
Interesting. But you know, it didn't. I mean, I guess it didn't scratch the one player itch.
No.
In the same way as something like Wario Land did quite, but then I wasn't really in a position to get a lot out of the multiplayer, which is, of course, a huge component of the game, really.
Right.
What I'd like to know is why he thinks it's a chore, because he doesn't really go into that.
Well, the familiarity would probably be my first guess, as you kind of suggested, John.
Yeah.
Carl, what say you here?
I think my favorite side-scroll on the Wii is probably the side-scrolling parts of Super Mario Galaxy.
Hey, that's
pretty good.
That's a decent answer.
You know, otherwise, really? I mean, all of my favorite side-scrollers from this generation were on other consoles, so I don't really have too many answers.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Well, we're hearing that the Galaxy 2 actually opens up with a fair bit of side-scrolling stuff.
That's awesome.
You know, ostensibly to ease in people who got into New Super Mario Bros. Wii and did not play the first Galaxy. Yes. So there might actually be more of that coming.
Like, my favorite side-scroller of the last couple years is probably Splosion Man. And so, yeah, that's not really on Wii. But, yeah, I don't know. I have an answer for the second question, but I assume we're going to wait a second to get to that.
Yeah, we'll continue with this for a little bit longer. Okay. I mean, other than the actual question of how much you like New Super Mario Bros. Wii, Johnny, you know, which one is your favorite?
First, I would say that I might include a couple extra side-scrollers that aren't retail games, so maybe they don't qualify in terms of this revival that Kyle writes about on the Wii. But I do think both of the Lost Winds games are very good side-scrollers on WiiWare. Nyx Quest also fits into that category fairly well, I think, and that's pretty interesting stuff that can only be done on... Both of those really are quite unique to Wii in terms of what they do with the controls and how they integrate that into, you know, fairly traditional 2D platforming. But my favorite side-scroller on the system is easily Wario Land Shake It. Easily. I think, and you know, if you know me, it shouldn't be a surprise because the one with the most intricate level design. And that's really what, you know, that's what interests me when it comes to platformers like this. So my feeling with New Super Mario Bros. Wii is that, I mean, I actually feel very similarly about it to Kyle in that I don't know, I was never all that excited about it. I knew I would get it, and I played it. I didn't mind playing it, but, like, sort of when I finished it, I'm like, I'm done with it. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not going to trade it in. I'm going to keep the disc for when multiplayer opportunities come up, and it's probably not going to be the first thing I suggest, but if somebody says, hey, let's play Mario, I'm not going to complain about that. I think it's perfectly fun as a multiplayer game, but I'm not going to go back to it as a single player. I'm done with it. I mean, it wasn't fresh enough for me. And so I did feel like sometimes it was fun, but sometimes it was kind of a bit of a chore. And there's just that ratio is a little too close for me. Yeah, it wasn't really what I wanted, but I'm not sorry that I played it. And I, you know, I don't mind having a copy. I'm not sorry that I bought it. I guess that's probably the way I should say it.
Yeah. Now I did enjoy Super Paper Mario. It got kind of tiring.
It's a disappointment for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how could anyone not be disappointed after it was hyped up so much in the early days of the podcast?
It looked so cool. I mean, it looked so fresh and
conceptually
and weird.
It was just the problem I had with Super Paper Mario was just that it was too padded. It was a bit like Muramasa.
Oh,
in the
sense
that there was certain sections, although I think Muramasa was more consistent. Because the thing with Super Paper Mario is there's certain sections which were plain interminable. The bit in space comes to mind, where I think you're literally foraging for toilet paper or something.
Yes,
very
you were looking for toilet paper for a guy in a stall, yes.
Because that bit is dreadful. It's simply dreadful, and it takes far too long. So,
well, even just navigating town in that game was kind
of
a pain in the butt.
Flip side or whatever. There was a lot of stuff there, just too long to do things to get on with it. And so, certainly, you know, I prefer the more immediate brand of, you know, 2D side-scrolling game like New Super Mario Bros. Wii or Wario, because I mean that's really kind of what I love about side-scrollers is that kind of gameplay that you don't tend to get in the more modern type of games. You know, I mean, that's the thing. Super Paper Mario and Muramasa are both side-scrollers that have the pacing of a different kind of game because they have RPG elements and this, that, and the other.
Right.
And so I still appreciate them, but they don't hit that spot.
It's the instant gratification.
Yeah, they don't hit the spot in terms of what is refreshing about this revival on Wii quite as nicely as the others for me. Anyway, we'll move on to the second part of the question now, which was, do you have a game that garners both critical and commercial success you just don't like, no matter how hard you try? And Carl, you were eager to answer this, seemingly.
Yeah,
so
I have a lot.
Oh, what is it? Scores will be settled.
It's not so much, again, and every game that I mention, I respect as a game. It's just that I don't particularly.
He's going to run out the entire Wii library.
Halo 3, I respect you.
I got to extend that olive branch because I don't want to get all the hate that I'm going to get after I say all these
but
games.
But you're not even on the show that often. You'll be fine. We're going to get your hate for you.
Yeah,
Kyle is sort of is seemingly implying some sort of level of respect in terms of how hard you try. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
I'm not convinced I've ever tried to like a game. Either do or I don't, but
All right. Well,
but I suppose if one were, it would be because you do have respect for something, or you...
Yeah, like, all right, first off, Eternal Darkness is a game that I would like to enjoy because it seems like a lot of other people like it, but I just don't.
Hmm. Did you play it when it first came out? Just out of curiosity?
No, I didn't. I played it years
that's
later.
The big
that's
difference.
Probably why. Yeah. And then I think it's been well documented all of my hate for Excite Truck. Which didn't really commercially sell well, so I guess that doesn't really count. But I think the biggest bombshell of a game that I don't
if you drop
really
Excite Bots, you're off the show.
No. This is probably a bigger deal than Excite Bots. Way bigger deal.
That's not saying much.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, a game series that I just wish I liked but don't is Metroid.
Oh.
Oh, you're with James.
Oh, no.
You sons of bitches.
Everyone that listened to that one-sided conversation episode that Johnny and Carl had once upon a time just gasped in shock.
Yeah.
For that statement.
I mean, look, I wish I can recognize that the Metroid Prime games especially, which I've really, really tried to get into, and of course, like Super Metroid and such, like, they're obviously really, really good games. Like, I can tell that by playing it. It's just not for me. And so, yeah, as much as I would like to enjoy Metroid, I just can't. Beyond that, any game from the Resident Evil franchise that was made before Resident Evil 4, you can't convince me that those are good games.
Right.
Because they're not.
I think that's conventional wisdom at this point.
Even when those games came out, there was something wrong with them. But people
yeah,
are
yeah. exactly.
I think
like,
they looked but good. The mainstream view has sort of shifted, hasn't it?
Right.
Right.
There's some revisionist history going on with the view of that game.
I think it was EGM who once said that Resident Evil, they once voted, I think amongst their staff, or maybe it was a listener or a reader poll, but EGM once declared that Resident Evil was the best game for PlayStation. This was before RE2 came out. Before RE2. But
if there were two games out for PlayStation and one of them was Resident Evil, that other game, regardless of what it is the best game for PlayStation.
Toshinden.
Those are pretty much the main ones, though. I'm sure there are.
Oh, you'd enjoy that, John. Thoroughly mid-90s reference, although you'd enjoy that.
There's also Ikaruga, which
everyone should
show.
Like Ikaruga.
Yeah, I mean if you know, you're a communist.
If ever there was a game for everyone, Carl, I mean, you're just...
Carl's just tossing Molotov cocktails out here.
Just Egg Dragon in particular.
Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of the Communist Party?
To be fair, the only reason I don't like it is because I can't play it.
No, Carl, I'm with you.
I think that's probably most people. I mean, even I struggle to play that game, and I'm very patient with treasure games.
It's because you care, Greg. You care, damn it.
Yeah, I had to learn to play that game.
I'm persistent, but that game is very challenging. Like, I mentioned it in my Sin and Punishment review. That game is intimidating. Just
yes.
to look
yeah.
at.
Yeah. Mean,
just to watch the action on screen makes people in the room who aren't even playing go, ugh.
Yeah, so that is not, I think, in the spirit of Kyle's question. It's John's obviously got the Galaxy one, so we can move on from that. James has got the Metroid one, so if you've got something else.
Actually, I mean, I don't hate this game. It's not that I don't really, really like this game.
Do you respect it, though?
I respect this game. It's that... Yes,
I take her out for a nice Saturday night dinner, whatever, I pay.
That's right. You know...
Just not gonna marry you.
That's right.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm not the world's biggest Galaxy fan, honestly.
Yes, James!
More
woo!
Love for Galaxy.
One more for the club, wow. Yeah!
And, wow. And it's not just Galaxy, though. It's Sunshine, it's 64. There's just something about those... I mean, I'm just... Those games just never... I mean, I enjoyed them, but they never really got me into them for some reason.
So, James, you're saying all 3D Mario games, basically.
Those three games... I mean, Mario 64 actually, probably to the least extent, but the other two, yeah. And I played Mario 64 way late in the N64's life for the first time. I just felt like there was something more about that game that I enjoyed, maybe because it was a newer experience.
Yeah, I really liked Mario 64. I actually love that game, but it just, after that, kind of just felt like the same thing.
Yeah, I suppose this raises the question of what the bar is for don't like.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Right.
Johnny, do you want to chip in?
Yeah. I'm having trouble thinking of something like within Nintendo's zone of influence that I would really put in this category, but definitely, if you broaden that out to all gaming, there's a couple of examples. Gran Turismo, I think I've mentioned before, cannot get into it. I mean, I can't play that game for more than like 10 minutes before I just get totally sick of it. And obviously, it's you know, meticulously crafted and huge commercial success. A lot of people seem to really like it. It doesn't do anything for me at all.
Yeah.
I agree.
That game is so sterile to me. That's about the only word I can use to describe it.
I mean, and that's the perfect word for it. Like the fact that, I guess the newest version is the first one where there's damage to cars.
Yeah.
I mean, that pretty much it defines it being sterile, literally.
Yeah.
And figuratively.
Yeah. And I think another one that, like a game that I've tried to play and could not get into it is Fallout, like the original, the 2D ones, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think I actually tried both of them. A friend gave me a disc with both of them on it a couple years ago. And, you know, he obviously was extremely nostalgic for these games. And the third one, I think, had just been announced or something like that. And I actually installed it and tried to play it, and I was like, it's just in general, my experience with Western RPGs has not been very good, and that's Diablo. Couldn't get into it.
Ugh.
I'm thinking. Oh, I'm trying to think of a couple others, but I mean,
several
Western RPGs, especially on PCs, that I've tried. Baldur's Gate, like Dark Alliance, stuff like that. I could not really get into it at all. It just doesn't appeal to me.
Any game where you're walking through a cave killing rats by clicking on them with a mouse.
I never got into Diablo.
That is my crack. That is crack for me. Just give me rats and swords with which to stab them. That is
Carl's crack is killing rats with swords and
oh, dude,
it's not the grind or the tedium that puts me off. It's we just started this game and you're going to spend 30 minutes with a character editor and like divvy up and allocate a bunch of points into stats that you don't really know what they do in the full game. It's like they give you so much control at the outset, but I'm a very like rules and order kind of person, and I want to know how these things are going to affect me down the line. And I feel like frozen in these decisions. Like, I don't know how many of these to put to strength and how many to put to charisma.
You must feel like you need to go to GameFAQs before you even start playing.
Exactly. And I don't mind making those kind of decisions later in the game when I feel like I have a context for it. But so many Western RPGs will start you out by literally throwing you into a character editor and giving you extended sessions of, like, defining all these details about your character. It's I don't understand where to even begin here.
Yeah, I mean, one of the worst games for that I've seen is Oblivion.
Oh yeah,
Elder Scrolls Oblivion is ridiculous. I mean, there's so many different things that you can build into your character that really really affect you in huge ways down the line. That really? I gave up. That's why I never played that game.
Yeah, I never got out of the caves in Oblivion
because I got so tired of because there's certain things where I was reading up about how you should make your character, and there's you must do this if you're going to be this type of character, otherwise down the line you will be screwed. And so you wind up just going to a fact file and just reading and reading and reading, and then you're like, you know what? Instead of reading and reading and reading, I could be playing and playing and playing something else.
Well, all right. Well, John, I completely empathize with what you're saying. Like, I never got out of the caves in Oblivion just because I was so bored with it. But I'll tell you what game really fixes that mechanic is Fallout 3.
Yeah.
I love Fallout 3. I don't know if you played it, but...
I have not played Fallout 3.
It takes the customization, and it cuts it back just enough so that it's not really annoying. Like, it's still in-depth, and you can still get, a lot of different variables, but it's not... so crazy specific that you're literally there all right, am I playing The Sims or Fallout? Eventually you do get to the part where you get into the action, and Fallout 3 is Oblivion but good, if you ask me.
Oh no.
To bring this particular question to a close, I think I'll just say I honestly don't run into this very much, because my purchasing habits are pretty conservative. In general, I don't tend to dabble much. It's genres that I know I'm not big on, like first-person shooters or RPGs. I'll just kind of have a few every now and then. And
well, I think, Greg, I admire you. It seems like you've been exploring a lot of different genres the past couple of years, especially since you got your PS3.
Yeah, getting the PS3, and there's a lot of affordable software options for it out there. Mm-hmm. Especially some of the older games. All that. Yeah, I mean, for the right price, you think, I'm willing to try it. And the thing is, you may not enjoy it as much as the real fans enjoy it, or as much as seemingly maybe the critics enjoyed it. But certainly for that price, you enjoyed it, so I would say, I don't like it. And then, you might not feel say, for example, I play through Killzone, you know, I may not feel like going getting Modern Warfare the next day, because it's like, well, you know, I've had my first person shooter fill, kind of, but you still enjoyed that period, you know, so yeah. I just haven't really run into something where I thought, yeah, I could have done without buying this. I think with Nintendo stuff, I've just, it's so dependable when you're gonna, what you're going to get from them, mm-hmm. normally.
You pretty much know all these games before you've ever played them.
I mean, apart from maybe stuff like on the most basic levels, like Wii Sports or something like that.
Right.
But, mm-hmm. you know, the appeal of that is so kind of obvious. You can kind of imagine whether you're going to enjoy it or not. And
then, right. And then when you made the jump to Wii Sports Resort, I mean, it was basically, you knew what you were getting.
Just... But yeah, but more involved and yeah. that sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, a few things like, I mean, even like Nintendogs, I mean, I got that cheap and it was, I didn't mind it. I thought it was quite good.
Did you get Dalmatian in France?
That was a pretty quick trade-in for me, Nintendogs. It was like, oh, this is neat. I'm surprised no one's ever done this before. But
and noted.
After like 2 weeks, I'm like, I'm not going to mess with this anymore.
I'm surprised no one's done it since in terms of Nintendo.
I know.
Nearly 5 years and we haven't had some sort of capitalization. It's quite strange. But we'll move on to the next letter. And James, you have this one.
Oswald, New York writes, in the last podcast, you guys mentioned Bioshock and how the story really isn't all that. I agree, but do you guys notice how it seems that many young or naive gamers are so quick to call a game a, quote, masterpiece or, quote, art, just because it tells a sort of adult story, also in quotes? I don't want to sound pretentious, even though I am, but it seems to me that was his parenthetical.
That's in the letter, yeah.
Yeah, James, that was not a quip.
I wasn't being a smartass. It's in the letter. But it seems to me that many gamers wouldn't know a good story if it hit them in the head. When a game like Heavy Rain is applauded for storytelling, you know there's something wrong. And parenthetically, he notes that he wasn't expecting Kafka, but a 12-year-old wrote it. It felt like a 12-year-old wrote it. I understand that games are a very young art form, but there's no excuse to accept bad writing. I don't want this to become a games or art discussion, but why is it that young gamers want to think a game that is realistic can be taken seriously, or only a game that's realistic can be taken seriously? With the exception of the work of Team Ico, I don't see anything that should be applauded. Mass Effect is a great game, but in no way would I say, as a review at Amazon said, this game has the best story I have ever experienced. Are these reviewers giving games that are different a high score just because they're different? I consider you guys to be intellectuals, and I would love to hear your opinions.
No, that wasn't it, James.
There's a certain parenthetical that was missed there.
Read it.
We're done.
I consider you guys to be intellectuals, yes, even James, and I would love to hear your opinions.
Thank you, John. So we'll begin on this one about, first of all, what about this issue about younger people perceiving things differently from older people? We've got a pretty good age spread on this between John and Carl. So.
Well, I'm 21. I'm not that young. But, I mean, as the youngest person on the podcast, I guess I can offer up some what the young kids are talking about these days. Pokemon. What's hip over on the street. I think the reason that, you know, he says, quote-unquote, young gamers or whatever that means, but... You know, as far as why they might gravitate to a story that's perceived as mature is because kids always want to be perceived as older. So why would a young guy want to be perceived as older? Because he plays older games. There you go. But it's interesting, though, what he says about Bioshock in that were you guys really trashing Bioshock so much for people regarding it as a good story? I really like Bioshock's story.
No,
I think
just,
it really
we,
falls
we, we were just kind of talking about the fact that I didn't think it was amazing in storytelling.
It's overrated, the story.
I don't think it was amazing, and I do agree with you that it's kind of overrated.
It's heavy-handed as well. I think that was my biggest
issue. Oh, for sure. Yeah. The whole deal with like where you walk in and it's like no god but man, and then there's like a huge glowing gold statue that's kind of stupid.
That was exactly my comment the other way.
Yeah, and it kind of all falls apart at the end. But I think that the reason that Bioshock is held up in such high regard when it comes to story is the same reason that Half-Life 2 is held up in such a high regard when it comes to story, in that it tells the game's story not through cinematics, but through actual gameplay. The story is revealed to you through your own experience. You're not sat down Metal Gear Solid style and like, hey guys, listen to a story for 45 minutes, then we're going to get back to the game part.
Yeah, I'm certainly far more amenable to that brand of storytelling in a game than the Metal Gear brand.
It's a first-person shooter, for all intents and purposes, and usually, typically, that genre has very bad stories. So it's very easy for it to look good. Not saying it's not, but it's everybody's like, oh my god, wow, first-person adventure shooter, whatever, with an actual good story. Somebody tried.
To put it in perspective, essentially, to go through three games that are relatively big shooters, although they're not all first-person, the Halo series, the Gears of War series, and the Fallout series basically all have the same story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's not exactly a great plot there. Aliens
fucking Jesus incarnate brings us back from the brink. That's what happens every time.
Yes. Some steroid rip dude goes and kills aliens to save
us. Oh, yeah.
Are you saying Jesus is fucking metal?
That's exactly what I'm saying, yeah.
Penny Arcade.
I think one of the key issues, I think, that obviously Oddworld's looking at in terms of age, but the critical thing is context. In the sense that, and obviously people's context is for storytelling is different according to their age, or, you know, in some cases because you've had longer to see various things, you know what I mean? It's obviously one of the biggest knocks on a lot of video game stories is that they're painfully derivative. And of course,
conduit.
If you're you know, younger, you don't have so much of a context for various sort of you know, classic kind of stories and sort of genres, it might be sci-fi or whatever, because that's used a lot in games, you might not see how painfully derivative something is, and therefore might find it more effective. So that's one reason why there could be this sort of generation gap.
And it's weird because games are usually derivative of each other, and and all it takes to turn the gaming media into a frothing ocean of hype is to be derivative of a different medium. Just like Bioshock, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they're basically ripping off a famous book from 50 years ago, and people are losing their shit over it.
Again, because they tried.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I certainly applaud the modicum of additional effort there, but
relative obscurity.
I think what you guys are saying is an excellent point in that we actually have come a long way in storytelling technique. In games, in terms of how interactive it is, and in terms of how it's integrated with actually playing the game, what needs to catch up is the actual content of story that's being provided through these storytelling techniques that we've gotten very good at. I mean, you look at Uncharted and Uncharted 2, which obviously have been very highly praised for the naturalism of the acting and the way that the story is just built right into the action. You know, a lot of times they don't even stop for cutscenes, and I applaud all of that, but you always have to give it with this caveat that the story itself isn't amazing. I mean, it's Indiana Jones, you know,
totally.
And it's good at that, but it's obviously not revelatory. And I would just say that maybe the reason that you're seeing, maybe if there is an age gap here, I'm not totally convinced that there is, but if there is, maybe it's because a lot of the kids, a lot of the younger people now grew up primarily getting stories from video games and less from other media. I mean, when I was growing up, I played video games for, you know, fun, but I was playing NES games. I mean, you're not getting rich story out of that. So I read books and I watched movies and I watched TV shows and I listened to music, and, you know, you can get stories through all these other media. And maybe now that we are getting to the point where games are now trying to tell epic, involved, rich stories, people are using that as maybe their primary storytelling outlet.
Or certainly weighted much more heavily.
Certainly. I mean, I'm not a big movie person because for whatever reason, I can't find the time to sit down and just kind of shut out for 2 hours. But I can play games for 2 to 4 hours because I'm doing something.
Or more, yeah.
But you think Skycrawlers has a good story.
Well,
I mean, I think the interesting point is we did have another letter from someone who I don't believe left their name, but they were talking about the idea of games converging with movies from the point of view of how stale the mainstream movie scene has got, and that the games are going the same way. And what Johnny was talking about in terms of, you know, in the end, the techniques are getting more sophisticated, but the stories that are being told are very obviously aping classic movie archetypes like the action adventure or the sci-fi or whatever. So, I mean, is it a valid fear that it's going to be equally as sort of homogeneous?
Well,
and
I mean, isn't it already?
Yeah, I don't... I mean, look, obviously, if games are just aping movies, then they're always going to be seen as Well, they're like movies, but not as good.
The little brother.
Like, yeah. You know, the best way to further the art of story in games is to find out how does a game tell a story better than a movie, and then focus on that mechanic. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're like, obviously you're introduced to a much deeper level of interaction than you are in a movie, because a movie is a passive experience and a game is an interactive experience. You need to capitalize on that for your story if you want it to actually be good and not just aping some sort of trope in a movie.
Well, I think the game I was speaking of earlier with Fragile Dreams kind of does that a little bit, mm-hmm. where it does sort of rip off these sorts of Last Man Standing movies that you see out there. But the fact that the creepiness is you, it's your experience. It's not watching someone be creepy. It's you looking around and observing things that in a movie,
totally.
The director obviously can't pan to show you every little scratch on a wall. It's yeah. your chance to make your way through.
I've always thought horror had a lot of potential in games that
totally,
that's still
yeah.
yet to be kind of fully explored.
Because you can truly ape someone's psychology there.
Oh, it's totally. More immersive.
I'm telling you, there is such a gold mine for a survival horror war game that has the potential to be so much more frightening and realistic than a war movie.
Oh, yeah. You're talking about like Conker's Bad Fur Day, the war chapter, but done realistically?
Not done by Conker's Bad Fur Day.
No, I mean, basically. I'm with you.
I think we actually talked about it on an episode of RFN once, but...
Yeah, that scene in Conker's Bad Fur Day, if they weren't using cartoon characters... You wouldn't be able to watch it. It's so fucked up.
Mm-hmm. It is.
No, there are scenes in that game that are so fucked up that if they weren't cartoon characters, you wouldn't be able to watch it.
It's. I mean, that game, especially the wars part, is pretty out there.
Of course, a game that's riddled with movie references.
Right.
It seems to be a lot of sort of parody or reference or, you know, so there is a feeling of games always kind of painfully reaching for legitimacy by sort of fawning over things that are perceived to be legitimate already.
Totally, yeah.
Well, I mean, the problem is we have, you know, over 100 years of film history. I mean, what's...
Yeah, well, but which gets back to Oswald's point about being a young medium, but at the same time, you know, do we accept bad writing?
Well, I think a lot of games actually have really good writing. They're just not really recognized for it. I mean, if you look at a lot of games, especially that have been, like, localized in OA, a lot of them have really great writing. They're maybe not so heavy on an actual story, but the writing itself is...
Right.
Top notch.
I think, I mean, it's kind of funny this has come up because, you know, going through all the RPGs I've been going through, you can see that there is a distinct difference between writing and story.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the Sakura Wars game has great writing because there's a lot of dialogue they had to write. The story itself is kind of juvenile, funny, goofy shit.
Yeah.
But the actual dialogue and the actual conversations are actually pretty well written.
But the story's terrible.
The story was terrible. I just said it. I said the story was goofy. And
that's mostly true. Most of the time, I mean, the stories are typically just like based on like, you know, your archetypal kind of rescue the princess thing.
The fact that we know that, you know, crossover medium types of stories don't work is whenever a writer crosses over from another medium to write a story for a game, it's always terrible. Case in point, Orson Scott Card, Event Rising. Terrible.
Oh, no.
Okay.
What about that Clive Barker game?
But any
that went down
Clive
badly.
Barker game is just awful, man.
So
like,
let me make one more point, and that's that am I worried that storytelling in games, or that the stories in games are converging with movies and will become equally stale? No, because I think it's based on the false premise that the movie industry is becoming more and more stale. I think really it's kind of always been that way. But mm-hmm. the good thing is that the umbrella is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, because as technology improves, more people are able to make movies for less money. And so you've always got original voices coming in. So even if the studio system, or even if the giant game publisher system becomes more and more stale and locked in, you've got more, the periphery just gets wider and wider and wider. And if you're looking for the things that those people are doing, you'll find it. And in case in point, I mean, if you think last year was a bad year for movies, I'd say you're watching the wrong movies. Because last year,
yeah.
there were tons of great, amazing new movies that came out in 2009. And you can find them if you look around. And I think in the last year, there were some very good stories told in gaming. But a lot of them were done in smaller games or games that are independent or just not all that well recognized. Maybe they're not put out by the big top three or four publishers.
So, or bad games with good stories.
Yeah, and again, I mean, I guarantee you last year there are more video games made and released than in any year before. It's just, the umbrella gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Especially just, with digital distribution, and that's only going to get bigger. And
it's just ballooning.
The question is, there's games that tend to be smaller, more insular, maybe 1-2-3-man projects. They don't really tend to be heavy story-driven things. They tend to be more focused on a simple concept than anything.
Sometimes. I mean, you have cases like Braid, which is sort of an alternative storytelling method. And I think
there are cases of it, but I think more or less you get stuff like Johnny's favorite developer, which would be Mommy's Best Games, where it's more action-oriented things.
Totally.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of space here to work in, and not all of them are interested in the same things. That's really the way it should be. You know, they're all trying different things. And, you know, hopefully, eventually, some of these people who specialize in different aspects of making games will team up and kind of combine their powers. And, I mean, I think it's inevitable. And the same thing happens in filmmaking.
I mean, I think one of the real sort of issues here as well is that if you're going to go for the sort of very cinematic brand of storytelling rather than that kind of more gameplay integrated version that we've kind of talked about,
kind of stuff,
then the technical barriers to entry there are significant in that, you know, just to get the, whether it be like performance capture and all that stuff right, is going to take very significant development machinery that most people don't have. So those games are going to be the preserve of the biggest companies with the most financial backing, and they're probably going to deliver stories that are meant to appeal to a mass audience like the studio, you know, the big studios in the movie scene. So that's the, you know, you haven't got to a point where a game could tell like a really sort of powerful emotional story on a tiny budget like a film could, because you'd still have the problem of recreating human performances in such detail would be incredibly difficult and costly to do.
Definitely.
So you've got a long, long way before that kind of independent part of the games industry can embrace that kind of storytelling. But it can't. I still think play to your strengths. Do play at the interactive stuff and sort of more different brands of storytelling that might not necessarily be so dialogue-driven or character-driven.
I must have heard this in the context of Heavy Rain, but someone was saying on a different podcast that if you put a camera on two people just talking and having a conversation, that's like the easiest scene to do in filmmaking and the hardest scene to do in a video game.
Yes, and exactly. The uncanny valley.
It just tells you, you know, you have to approach these things from different directions. They are different media, and you can tell a story in both of them, but you have to go at it from a different direction because of technology, maybe because of interactivity as well.
Well, and the problem is that it's also very hard to create a kind of – I mean, there's a whole set of movies that tend to be regarded as having high story, which is more, you know, interpersonal conflict, which is prime material for storytelling, but to be a game, that's not really all that interesting.
Maybe it can be.
Maybe, but it doesn't really...
Hitherto, it seems difficult to build a game around that.
Yeah, I mean, the game mechanics become difficult. So
I mean, the idea of a sort of ensemble piece is sort of antithetical to the way that games have been put out so far. Right. Yeah, but
it's kind of like, well, do you sacrifice gameplay for story or story for gameplay? I mean, there's a certain amount of give and take that has to take place there.
It's funny that you bring that up, James, because it turns out... My boy, Goichi Suda, has that exact problem.
No. Yes, he does.
Because, you know, I was holding back trying to bring up Killer 7, but I know that I only enjoy that story and that no one else, like, it's...
I'm sorry. You know, listeners at home, I'm sorry.
I'm not going to go into it because obviously people have made their opinions known and they're wrong and it's okay.
I like that game, but honestly... Honestly.
No, I love the story, man. People say that it makes no sense. I can explain the story. I'm not going to do it here, obviously, but like I can explain the story to you extremely easily. It's a very simple story.
Dude's crazy. There's your story.
Print it.
Well, spoilers.
So, yeah, Bit Trip Runner. That's it.
Bit Trip Runner.
That is the end of that question. And now I believe, John, you have the next one.
All right. Jet Pilot writes, "Hello, podcast crew. I really enjoy your weekly show." Thank you, Jet Pilot. "Why do you think that Nintendo concentrates so hard on the Japanese market when the overseas markets, North America and Europe, are so much bigger and much more lucrative? I understand that Nintendo is a Japanese company, but they are a business, so you would think that they would follow the money. It continues to amaze me when they still treat their biggest markets as secondary when it comes to most hardware launches, game design, and game releases.
I can answer this question extremely easily and tell you that it is because their shareholders are Japanese.
Yeah, the investors are Japanese.
Their corporate leadership is Japanese. And so, pretty much anybody with power, with the exception of Reggie, is Japanese.
Yeah, well, I mean, they also have a vested interest in keeping the Japanese market healthy. It's their own market.
Yeah, I don't know how much that really... I know there's a certain pride to mm-hmm. being successful in their home country, but that's not a great business case to make. I think the other than the investors being Japanese, which is an excellent point, the other main motivating factor here is that it's economically... They get more out of selling their things in Japan because they save on shipping and because of the value of the yen as compared to the currencies in the other markets. So they actually, if they sell a Wii in Japan,
the margin's better.
They make a lot more money on it than they do if they sell that same Wii for an equivalent price in America.
The margin's certainly better in Japan. And then the other thing is that what we've seen over the past few years, of course, is that whereas, say, for instance, the DS and the Wii kind of took off relatively quickly in Japan, they might have been a little slower to get going elsewhere. But that effect of generating more revenue from the other countries has been a sort of offset by movements in the currency markets where the yen has got stronger. So the revenue that they've been pulling in from those other territories has become worth less to them. And so that's been a sort of countervailing force against putting more emphasis on the Western markets and stuff. But, I mean, I think the other interesting angle to look at this question is you could say that, you know, what they did with the DS, what they did with the Wii, was a very Japanese solution to a very Japanese problem, in the sense that, you know, they were, you know, trying to revive the console market to some extent with the Wii. But then those models that seem so Japanese have been explosively successful everywhere else. So you might say, well, now is certainly not the time to change that approach because it served them so well.
Well, mm-hmm. for a couple decades now, there's been this sort of operational theory that things that are popular start in Japan like a year or two in advance. But in this case, it was this very specific problem, like Eric talks about, where the gaming market in Japan had fallen out.
Mm-hmm. Nearly a crash.
I mean, things there still aren't amazing. If you think about what it is they targeted, it's not so much that they targeted Japan. It's that they targeted people who would enjoy games, but currently aren't.
They targeted apathy.
I suppose the point is that in Japan, that was something of a question of necessity.
Right, that might have been their inspiration, but how they went about it isn't really Japanese, it's everyone. I mean, they basically said, what would make people who aren't playing games want to play them?
Mm-hmm.
And they said they went about, and this might be a more Japanese approach of handling things, but really this is an approach that any person who's really trained in sort of engineering and social engineering would think about. What is it that makes it so games aren't fun for people? And their answer was, well, people don't like complex control. You could argue they've made control much more complex, but...
Certainly made the controllers more complex.
Yeah, that was their operational theory that they were working on, especially in the case of the Wii.
Yeah, just make more accessible interfaces, you know, remove barriers to entry as much as possible. You know, the trade-off nostalgia where they can, of course, you know, to the sort of the days of the Famicom especially, which were very good for them, you know, incredibly buoyant period. Of course, that was probably the last time the Japanese economy was actually good as well, unfortunately, obviously a sort of systemic problem. So, I mean, they certainly do have to look to other shores they're doing a much better job, I think.
Especially in Europe.
In Europe, they're really realizing the potential. Iwata come out with some comment just recently about how apparently people in Japan and the UK are the quickest to respond to new things now. I guess this means he likes us.
Well, you're still not getting excited, but... So.
I'm sure that means that we'll get Wii Party a week before the US.
I'm sure there's more Leahy hunger strikes to come, I'm sure.
I was going to point to one example where they really did redesign a game for the home islands, and that's the Legend of Zelda.
Yeah, Phantom Hourglass and Spirit Tracks, yeah. But and also, I mean, Other M appears to be very, you know, Sakamoto has said as much that it's a similar sort of process. So, you know, maybe that's some of what's motivating what Jet Pilot's writing in this letter. It's a little bit confounded that you'd care that much, but I think the investor's point is crucial. I mean, that was very well put to start us off on this discussion, because, I mean, at the end of the day, you could say it's sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy with Japan will say, look, you know, it's not us that's obsessed with Japan. It's our investors that can't kind of think outside the box. So don't blame us. But then the investors are thinking that Nintendo are obsessed with Japan and so on. So, you know, you can't disentangle that. It's kind of a chicken and the egg situation. But and it is, as Johnny said, it's the more secure sort of income stream. Yeah, because you've got the good margins and you've got the protection against currency fluctuations.
And it's reliable. I mean, they can rely on a certain number of sales in Japan that they can feel confident in. Like, we can, there was a time where all the wacky shit came out in Japan, not just because Japan has an insatiable appetite for wacky shit, but because you could release something in Japan, say, okay, if it doesn't work, well, we just released it in Japan. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. I mean, I am happy that on the one hand, yeah, they're still delivering products that bear their Japanese origins very strongly. But at the same time, now they're far more willing to try them everywhere else. Yes. You actually give them a shot, you know, stuff like, you know, Rhythm Heaven and various, you know, I'm glad that we're seeing that now, that whereas in the past, I don't think they would. So I think, you know, in general, the direction of travel is a good one.
One thing worth noting, though, is I'm curious how much foreign development assets they hold now versus how much they held or at least operated 10, 15 years ago. I have to imagine the number is down quite a bit, because
They divested themselves of a number of Western developers, you know, from Rare, Silicon Knights, Left Field Studios,
Factor 5. At least they broke their relationship with Factor 5, essentially.
Yeah, there wasn't so much an investment there, but also they've, as far as we can tell, they've pretty much shut down Nintendo Software Technologies.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
I see no evidence to the contrary.
No, we're still waiting for Retro to break the streak.
Yeah, right. Maybe Retro has been shut down too, for all we know. I certainly hope not.
But don't start rumors like that.
There's an interesting element of globalization here, and I don't want to turn into Thomas Friedman of gaming, but I do think globalization is an interesting player here, in that Nintendo would have more American holdings if it needed them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So basically, I don't know how much people know about this, but, you know, Nintendo of America is less than 100 employees, considerably less than 100 employees. And they do operate they have one factory in America. It's in North Bend, Washington, where they print some discs, I think, and they put things in packages.
Right.
But most of the things that they're packaging are shipped over from Japan. And they used to not even have that. I mean, they used to even package things in Japan and ship them all the way over. So almost all of Nintendo's operations are out of Japan, and then they just kind of export things over. And that's why their business is so export heavy. And they would be a lot less dependent on currency fluctuations and Japanese shareholders and things like that if their other branches had more autonomy, if they, you know, if Nintendo of America developed its own games, printed its own games, published its own games, manufactured its own version of the console, and did all of that independently, it might even have American investors, etc. And then the same goes for Europe as well. And instead, all of this is run out of corporate headquarters in Japan, and these are almost like skeleton forces in the other regions. I mean, I know Nintendo of America, in terms of like profit and income versus number of employees, is like one of the most successful companies in the history of
America.
Yeah,
this isn't something like for every employee, they make something like $1.3 million of profit
I remember seeing that going, the hell?
It's insane.
Yeah. It's crazy, but that's because most of what they do is sell things that were made in Japan.
Yes.
And the globalization has made it easy for Nintendo to ship things all over the world for very little money, and also to be much more aware of the tastes of all these different countries and all these different people in all these different places. And so they've gotten a lot better at developing games that can be successful on a worldwide basis. So they don't, I think from Nintendo's point of view, they don't really need to custom tailor games for different regions. They can just make things that everybody likes. And so it's just cheaper for them to stay in Japan and do all of that out of there and just sell it elsewhere.
Yeah.
Whereas you see companies like, you know, certainly Microsoft is in a completely different situation.
The opposite situation almost.
And even Sony is, because Sony of America is far more independent of Japan than Nintendo is.
Well, moving on, we have this next letter from Abdul in Saudi Arabia. He wrote to quite a long, thoughtful message with multiple questions in it. I'm just going to use one for now, at least. He says, I've been listening to your podcast for months now, and I have to say, I'm amazed at how good your show is and how little recognition you guys get. It really is a shame to see such a well-done podcast not getting the attention and proper recognition it deserves. Going to do something about that, John?
John's going to make sure that it's worse.
I'm going to streak through a major event sometime
E3.
Soon.
John's going to streak through E3
with
and
RFN
be blinded.
Written all over myself.
I want to see you in the stands at Ralph Wilson Stadium with RFN in red and blue on your naked chest.
I'm going to become the RFN guy. That's what I'm going to call myself.
By the way, if you want to do something about that, if you think we deserve more recognition, the best thing you can do right now, at least, is go to iTunes and write a review and give us a rating on the stars, because that helps a lot. That helps people find us.
If you really want to help us with it, the best thing you can do is force people to listen to it. But that's probably...
Yeah, I mean, seriously, tell your friends.
Armed coercion, to be honest. That's the best, most effective.
Well, on to one of Abdul's questions, anyway. It seems there's a rather large demand for having a Super Smash Bros. Game on the 3DS. I can't understand why people would want that. To me, enjoying Super Smash Bros. Means sitting with my family or friends in front of a TV and playing side by side on the same screen. I know this could be done on four different 3DSs, but setting up such a thing would be a pain in the ass. I can understand wanting such a game on the go if you live in Japan and pretty much guarantee that on every bus or train ride you'll find people to play against. But living outside of Japan, the argument doesn't hold up one bit. Check the example of Monster Hunter on PSP. My question is simple. Would Super Smash Bros. Actually be better on a portable system, and why?
Not better, but potentially quite compelling if it has very good local multiplayer, and I'm sorry, it needs online.
Mm-hmm. It does.
Because for the good very reason online. That you cannot play it multiple players on the same screen. I mean, most likely not. So it needs to have much better online than Brawl, and then that would actually be something I'd play a lot.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I think the best route they can go with here is to go kind of do the same thing that they did with Mario Kart DS, which is, if you ask me, the best... It's the best kart racer in the series, and probably the best kart racer ever. So, I mean, yeah, obviously the online needs work. I mean... Look, Nintendo Online in general needs work, but you know if they can get that up to par, and you know my biggest concern really with Super Smash Bros. On a handheld is that you don't have an analog stick.
Well, that we know of. I mean,
well, that
3DS,
we know of. Yeah,
everything could be crazy.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I just don't think they're gonna put a nub on there. I don't see that happening. But
I think they will. But
really?
You don't necessarily need an analog stick.
I don't play Smash Brothers with an analog stick. I use
Brawl has that Wii remote only version. But mm-hmm. I think the fact that no one likes to play that is probably a good indication of.
Yeah, but if
its
you could design
quality.
The game around, if that was your primary control scheme, it could
be
a different matter. They could make some changes that made it more palatable.
Definitely, yeah.
And obviously, you wouldn't be dealing with the two button kind of thing quite so bad. You know, you wouldn't have like the block problems and stuff.
Of course,
that you've got
right.
With,
you have at least six face buttons to work with. Plus a D-pad, I think you could make it work.
Yeah, I mean, they could make it work. I think that's really the issue, is that to the extent that there is demand for a Smash Bros. Game on a handheld, it's not really as a sort of superior or a replacement version for what we already have, because I think Smash Bros. Is pretty much the ultimate get around the same TV, because you don't have to deal with split screen.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
And that kind of raucous kind of action there is to it is perfect for that. Mm-hmm. But it would be as a substitute. Like you said, plenty of people, who live in Japan, or to be fair, densely populated urban areas elsewhere in the world, they do exist, in America, Europe, or anywhere else. The people use public transport a lot, use their portables a lot, they probably enjoy it. And don't forget, kids, If you've got the Wii or some Nintendo console of the future set up in the living room, they can't use that all the time because it would drive their parents crazy. There's other things to watch on TV and all that. But the handhelds, they obviously subject to parental discipline, they can use it pretty much any time they want. So there would definitely be demands for kids to be able to keep playing something like Smash Brothers on a portable if it were there. And of course, by extension, therefore, it's a huge money spinner for Nintendo. So it's more a case of all a little bit sort of baffled as to why it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if it's so much just huge overwhelming demand for it is. It's just shock that it hasn't happened already. I mean,
I think the reason it hasn't happened is because they haven't gotten Sakurai on it. I don't think he wants to do it. And who are you going to get to develop a Smash Brothers game who isn't Sakurai?
Yeah, I think they could find somebody. I just wonder if they're maybe struggling with how to design it in a way that they feel is compelling.
Yeah, that's fair.
That's probably fair, but I think that book's been written now with some of those other kind of character brawlers that came out on the DS a few years back. I think they can kind of look at that and say, we can work from this and do it better.
Yeah, I mean, do you think there might be a problem with the DS hardware in terms of maybe the zooming in, zooming out kind of thing?
Yeah, it can. It's just a matter of, can it do it with that many characters on the screen moving at the speed of a Smash Brothers game?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, my thoughts would be it could, but evidently they just didn't feel like it was quite the right match. But I do feel as if it'll be a matter of time. But yeah, I mean, I think the Mario Kart DS analogy is an important one. But I think, I guess, the biggest upside of the handheld thing is you don't have to deal with split screen there. So
that's
true. Kind of, that there is an advantage there of kind of having your own screen to play it on that you don't have with Smash Brothers. So I can kind of understand you might be looking at that a little more skeptically in terms of taking it down to a handheld. But I still think that, all the arguments are sound for why it would still be very popular.
Oh, just to think about it this way, those of us that were at PAX East, how many people do you think we would have seen playing that game if it existed?
Oh, constantly.
There would have been entire rooms dedicated to it.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
totally.
That game would sell.
Yeah, of course. I think, if anything, we might just see a repurposed, Melee on 3DS with just, maybe a brand new control scheme.
3D effects!
Oh, God, I hope not.
You watch Jigglypuff get smashed into your face.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome.
Stuff like that coming right through the screen at you.
When Link drinks the milk, it actually flies at you.
Oh, there you go.
I want to throw out a quick suggestion here, and this is, I'm just thinking off the cuff, but I'm getting ideas.
Here comes the crazy pants.
But I know there's an issue of being able to crowd around the same screen to play Smash Brothers, and maybe one way they could do it is with maybe some potential functionality of 3DS. What if you could tether a Wii remote to that handheld and use that as a second controller? So you're still sharing the same screen, but now you both have full sets of controls.
I just don't like the idea of sharing a handheld screen with another person.
It'd be certainly, if we're talking about the 3D element being strong, that could be problematic in terms of
Maybe they turn that off for this
angles
game.
Of view.
Yeah, they might, but it's problematic with the view, because obviously you've got DSi XL, and they say, we've opened up the viewing angle, and you can both see it, and all that kind of stuff. So from that point of view,
you can see
the DSi
XL from space. Let's be honest.
Johnny, the problem I have with that idea is that Sony has done it, so therefore that automatically makes it a bad idea. Because you can hook up a PS3 controller to the PSP
Yes.
Go. So
it's not, right. To be fair though, the PSP Go was prefaced as a bad idea.
You can't really
build anything from that.
I think there's some potential there in the future.
Mm. I suppose it'd be one way if they somehow manage to make your classic controller interact with it, one way for people to maintain the analog stick purity of their control scheme or whatever.
But then you'd have to carry around the 3DS and a set of controllers with you. I just don't see that working.
But it would be a very supplementary kind of option if it were in there, obviously.
You can hook up your Virtual Boy to your 3DS and play everything in red.
Oh, come on, James. I mean, I think it's more about taking your 3DS with your game to a friend's house who does not have either. And what does he have over there? Of course, he has a Wii with a bunch of Wii remotes. It's more about just being able to throw this stuff together ad hoc.
So
it's not a very Nintendo-like idea. I'm just saying it could work.
It's almost a connectivity in reverse.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. Yeah, exactly.
All right, that is pretty much going to close that. But Johnny, I believe you have a very critical, important listener mail to close us out.
That's right. This is a letter from Ganji Ness, who writes, "The Drunk Cast was still better than episode 103.
Never forget.
Never forget.
So, James, you know, you spent that whole time acting all superior, all hoity-toity with your little finger in the air. And you presided over the biggest clusterfuck this show has ever seen. So I think you should...
To be fair, nobody fell out of a fucking bed during 103.
How do you know?
Let me just go on the record. I think the Drunk Cast is way more of a clusterfuck than 103, but it's also more entertaining.
Nobody lit fire in a crowded room during 103.
All apocryphal stories can't be proven.
No, the fire can be proven.
I mean, look, you know, 103, look, you guys trash it and whatever, but I defy you to say that you didn't have fun while you were recording it.
Well, Johnny wasn't here.
Well, Johnny wasn't around, but...
Johnny didn't have fun listening to it either, because
I'm
he came
sure.
back with checkpoints to talk about in the next episode.
I didn't have to edit it back then, so...
I mean, you're sure to have fun in a state of anarchy.
I had to edit it, and that was the most bizarre edit ever, because I'm like, do I cut this? But if I cut this, I have to cut that.
Yeah, just leave it all in.
I don't think I left it all. I think I took out a few minutes that were just like people going brrr at each other and horrible.
No, I mean,
just terrible
look,
noises.
It's funny, man. I talk to Stan every now and then. We keep in touch pretty often, and he loved that recording. Like,
yeah. He seemed to enjoy it quite a bit more than the reunion show.
Funny about the reunion show. Like he was feeling pretty ill at that point. He was actually kind of a big deal that he even showed up. He was like in and out of the hospital at that point. But I mean, no, he showed up and he mumbled a few words and then stumbled out. But I mean, you know,
need to get
look.
Stan back on for realsies.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think someone PM'd me the other day asking me if there was going to be an episode 203, and I told them that...
No!
It's not within your power to decide that.
It's not really... Yeah, that's what I told him. It's not really up to me, but I don't really think you could ever recreate... I think if you called something 203 and you really were, like, going to make it like that, it wouldn't be funny because it would
no,
be forced.
No.
I mean, look, as for, you know, which podcast is better, The Drunk Cast or episode 103, it's like picking one of my children. Like, what am I gonna go with here? But, I mean, obviously, I think that I probably have more memories of The Drunk Cast more importantly, what happened after The Drunk Cast.
Oh. It was quite an evening.
Grapple them titties, Johnny.
No comment.
By the way, the best part is getting
alcohol's a hell of a drug.
The best part is getting that story from two different people on the phone the next morning, and it being completely different, and being like, "What the fuck happened? They just walked home."
All right. So, in other words, I win. Drunk Cast is better than 103, and that's gonna end our episode this week. Thanks to everybody who wrote in, and you can send your email with questions, comments, suggestions, anything you want to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Please do. We do read everything. Also, as I mentioned before, we'd really appreciate it if you rated and reviewed us on iTunes. Of course, we've got Radio Trivia and the Newscast, our sister podcast. And, Carl, you want to tease reset button number 2?
Yes, reset button number 2 is coming out. You'll be hearing this, I guess the podcast is coming out on Sunday, so in 4 days or maybe 3 days if you're listening to it on Monday. So reset button number 2 is I'm going to go ahead and tell you what the game is. The game is The Lion King for the Super Nintendo, which is an awesome game that I was, to be honest, I didn't think I was going to get the interview. I got the interview with Lewis Castle, formerly of Westwood Studios, and then later was a really big gun over at EA. He was one of the executive producers on Boom Blocks, worked with Spielberg, and then now he's over at Instant Action doing... like online games, but it's a really great interview. We have the podcast version, which is going to be going up next weekend, is actually really fantastic. We talk about working with Spielberg beyond just The Lion King. He talks about things that it was funny. They worked on The Lion King, the game, while they were working on the movie. And so he has some really interesting anecdotes about things that got left on the cutting room floor for the movie, even.
Like hit detection?
That was guy of the movie.
That was guy of the movie. Yeah, yeah.
We used to refer to it as the, as like the unknown Kitty Pryde simulation game, The Lion King, because like there's all these platforms and things where the character just goes straight through.
Even so, though, it's still, like, I hold it in the same regard as, like, Aladdin or that Mickey Mouse game that Capcom made, which
oh, yeah, no, it's not nearly as good as those. But, I mean, the production values are really high, and it's just weird because, like, other than that, it doesn't really seem to have a lot of major technical issues, but the collision is... Yeah. Seriously screwed on that game. It's also really hard.
It's a difficult game. And he actually talks a little bit about.
Is this a trend, Carl?
No, it's
Ghosts and Goblins. For number three.
No, they have to be licensed. So difficult and licensed.
No. I mean, it's kind of there was another game that was going to be coming up next that was not licensed, and I was really happy to have that because I didn't want everything to be so similar. But it just so happened that Lewis accepted.
You didn't
want
your mom to think you're only into that kind of game,
there you
but
go.
That's just the kind that you keep bringing home.
So what are we looking at after this? Festus Quest, probably.
You got to keep bringing.
Festus Quest would be a great one.
Bring home a nice game next time, would you?
But yeah, so Reset Button's coming out. The text version is coming out on Thursday. I'm tweaking the format a little bit, so it's a little bit more streamlined than the first one. I know some people were criticizing the fact that it's broken up so much, so
don't show weakness.
That's right.
As long as your criticism is constructive, I will hear you out.
Why are you picking all these licensed games?
But yeah, so look out for Reset Button coming up on Thursday, and then the audio podcast interview is going to be coming up the following Sunday. And I don't really know how it's coming out. It's probably going to come out, I guess, in its own MP3. It's like 45 minutes long, so
yeah.
I don't know if you guys would necessarily want to just tack it onto another episode.
That's right. Thursday, May 20th, by the way, just to be clear.
Thursday, May 20th. Look for it. Should be up that morning. And then also keep in mind, like I said before, send on over all of your emails that you don't think are necessarily right for this podcast to mailbag@nintendoworldreport.com. That's coming out every Monday. So you're going to be getting this on a Sunday. So literally the next day, you're going to have your new bi-weekly Monday morning-ish mailbag.
Bam, bam, bam. Every day, there's something new at the site.
Yeah, features day. Coming out the yin yang. Check it out. It's coming soon.
Wham, bam. Thank you, ma'am.
No.
All
John.
Right. Guys, thank you all for listening. Thanks to the crew here for doing this every week. Thanks to Greg for editing. And thanks to Carl for being our special guest this week. We will talk to you next time on Radio Free Nintendo.
Ba-da-ba. Take care, folks.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Peace.
John is up next, and I know you've barely played your game, but you're still going to make me really jealous.
Or not.
Hello,
John, are you dead?
John left.
John's out playing his game right now. But...
Sorry, I was muted.
John, what the fuck was that?
I had my headset muted. Sorry.
Why?
Because you want to know why? Because I'm eating apricots, James, and people have complained about people eating stuff. If you want the truth, if you want to know, if you want the inside baseball,
of all the food you could have picked, apricots.
Dirty laundry,
wow, John.
Right there, eating apricots, dried frickin' apricots.
Look, I will mute it afterwards. Just don't eat them while you're talking. That is easy.
Yeah, seriously.
Greg, honestly, the chapter art for this needs to be apricots. So.
And I mean, really, John, apricots, really? Like, what color skirt are you wearing?
Orange, like apricots. Okay? All right? Are we done here? Are we finished making fun of the old guy?
What the game does is, Cassetto is just, you know, he's just a kid who's stuck in this world by himself now. He's not a fighter. Which is kind of a standard of the survival horror franchise. Mm-hmm. So,
what's that?
Like a tugboat?
Yeah, that was a motorcycle just like
driving through your room, apparently.
No, dude. Like maybe 15 feet from my apartment, there's like a really busy street. And so, basically, like, fucking these Miami assholes just love to, like, speed down it. Ugh.
Hey, welcome to Florida, buddy.
Welcome to Florida, bitch. Yeah, exactly. Hope you brought money. I think I probably have more memories of the drunk cast. And more importantly, what happened after the drunk cast.
Oh.
It was quite an evening.
Can we just tell the story? Because the people
No, we can't tell that story.
Come on.
Well, you can tell it, and then I will decide what to do with it.
Okay. Let's just tell it. Come on.
Because I don't think Greg's heard it.
Because people who are listening are
I've not heard. I've not heard any of this.
It's the worst thing on podcasts when people like reference something and they don't explain it. People who are listening are like, let's just tell it. So let's just tell it. Like, whatever, fine. Well, after the drunk cast, it was Neil, myself, Johnny, Lindy, and Obi. We were walking to get some food because we were drunk and just.